Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 106 for June 9th, 2011. We are going to clean their socks. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Hey, thanks for tuning in with us again, folks. It's great having you back with us, and it's great me being back with the Auto Extremist, Peter DiLorenzo, here in the studio.
Buongiorno, Gianni.
And also, as I said in today's show, we're having a cameo appearance by none other than Jason Vines.
It's so good to be back.
It is good to have you back, too. So lots to talk about. I mean, I know I say that every week, but industry is amazing.
It's another quiet week in the business, really.
Well, you weren't quiet, man. You had your mouthpiece going about Dan Akerson, who stuffed it in his mouth again, shoved his shoe in there.
Well, you know, this interview in the Detroit News, but, you know, a lot of journalists in town have been trying to get interviews with
the CEO of General Motors.
Yeah, and the news gets their shot, and they get 2 hours, and wow, Dan just kept talking and talking and talking. And I mean, some of the things he said, I was just, Jason, you know, you're the consummate PR pro. I mean, what did you think of what happened?
Well, let me preface that a little bit, just so anybody trying to catch up to speed with us. I mean, I've been after Akerson because, you know, he's been trash-talking other car companies. You know, he calls the Toyota Prius a geek-mobile and the people who buy it geeks. He put down the Mercedes C-Class because he said, oh, it's C, it's average, it's like a C student. And then in this Detroit News article that Peter's talking about, he trash-talks Lincoln.
Well, he said several things. First of all, he equates what we're doing here as a war. And, you know, frankly, when we have servicemen and women dodging real bullets and coming back in body bags, you know, we don't need to do that. I mean, this is competition, vicious competition, and careers are at stake and jobs are at stake, but it's not war. And, you know, Dan is a veteran, a proud naval veteran, and that's good, but I was surprised he did that, and I thought it was inappropriate. You know, anytime Dan goes after the competition, he doesn't have any credentials to do that. Now, if it's Bob Lutz doing it, who's probably forgotten more than, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, we've learned to accept that, and Bob has a right to do it. Dan doesn't have any credibility to do that. And to say Lincoln is dead and, you know, pour holy water on it was just, really? You got to be kidding me. And because, you know, Ford's gearing up that Lincoln thing, and, you know, we'll see about it. But they're not dead.
No.
And then the final thing he said was talking about GM needing a cultural revolution on the order of, you know, the communist China.
Yeah, revolution.
Yeah, first of all, GM hasn't had a real culture since the 50s and 60s. They've been culturally bankrupt. And then to bring up Mao's name, I mean, you know, this guy was responsible for eliminating a lot of his fellow Chinese. So it was just a train wreck of an interview. I mean, and I said in my column, at one point, I would think Selim Bingo wanted to pick up Dan by the lapels or throw the Detroit News reporters out of the room and say, this interview is over because it can't get any worse. But, you know.
So let's ask the PR expert. And remember, everybody, Jason ran Nissan PR North America. He ran Ford PR Global, and he ran all of Chrysler Public Relations as well. Well, I mean, do you read this the same way that Peter and I are reading it? A lot.
The same way. I'm not as sensitive on the war issue because we use that all the time and the crosshairs, you know, Sarah Palin's responsible for the disaster in Arizona. I really do believe it is a war for General Motors. And one that they can win, but if they don't watch out, they're going to lose because of Ford Motor Company. Ford Motor Company went to Congress with Chrysler and GM, knowing that if the industry failed, if those two failed, Ford would eventually fail because the supply base would be wiped out. But they still went there. Kind of, all right, we're all in this together. Ain't in this together anymore. And Ford, they had their sights on General Motors to destroy them. When I was at Ford, I learned that at General Motors, at both at Ford in the engineering department, there are signs that say F Ford, F GM. They hate each other with such a passion, so it is a war. So from that standpoint, it's just saying those words. Maybe he can do it because he is a veteran, but it can go a little too far.
But what about trash talking the competition?
He's not the first person at GM to do that. It's always been bad. And let's just look a couple years ago, those ads with Howie Long, when they trashed the Dodge pickup because it was wussy. They trashed the F-Series because it had the step up. You know, when you are at the top of your game, why talk about the others? And why go down and just, you know, the old Steve Martin line, if you don't have something nice to say about someone, you must be talking about the Ayatollah Khomeini. But, you know, talk about yourself. If you've got good stuff, talk about yourself and don't bring the other guys in. And I think GM has got some great stuff, you know, thanks to Maximum Bob putting this stuff in place and run with it.
But probably the most egregious thing he did was label future Cadillacs as okay, you know. And I heard from some top-level GM engineers saying, hey, let me just say, we don't work 24/7 to make this stuff great, to have our so-called leader go out and say that it's just okay before it even hits the streets.
Not only that, he was saying that, you know, all these people would just check out at 5 p.m.
That's the other thing. And he said, let me just say, this guy just lost the entire product development team. No one checks out at 5. I mean, I got a blistering email from this guy, which, you know, everyone says, well, you got some good letters this week. You have no idea the stuff we don't print.
And including photos of Anthony Weiner?
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, here's this guy. When you're immersed in this business, you realize how hard these people work in this town everywhere. Chrysler, Ford, GM.
The suppliers.
This isn't a 5 o'clock ending.
No, it's not. And it's never been. No, and that's why, you know.
We start at 5 a.m., by the way.
Too. Yeah.
And talk to a lot of wives and or husbands of the spouses that work at these companies.
Yeah. I mean.
You know, they're always on the verge of divorce because they never see each other.
Yeah. And so that's another thing that Mr. Ackerson said, you know, that was just, at the very least, unfortunate because, you know, these people work their asses off all the time. I mean, and to write people off, say, well, we're going to end that 5 p.m. thing. It's just like, really, Dan? No one I know in this business leaves their job at 5, whether they physically or mentally. It's 22 hours a day.
What he can't do. He can't do a Nardelli.
What do you mean by that?
That's a new verb.
Yeah.
Is it a verb?
Yeah. He can. He's real close.
Well, he has time to avoid it, but he's in danger of going down that path of crapping on everyone that's there and crapping on history and demoralizing the troops.
Well, like I said, he's dismissed what's gone on before him as, well, they just weren't smart enough. And taking credit for all the stuff that's out there now, which he didn't have credit for, you know, has nothing to do with. And then saying from this point on, it's going to be fabulous because.
I mean, look at Mulally. I mean, we can't say it enough. He took a really endangered Ford.
Correct.
And built a team and said, I'm with you. I'm going in the trenches with you. To use your war analogies, I'm going with you. Stick with me. I'm going to kick your ass. If you screw up or aren't trying, and they've gone through it. It's been marvelous.
But, you know, one thing Alan did is this is our plan and brought everyone on board, so this is where we're going. We're not going to deviate from this. This is what we're doing. And everyone, you know, knew where they were going. But, you know, I don't think anyone really, what is Dan's plan?
Well, I think to your point, you know, is Mulally talked about the team. Mulally talked about the vision, the one for it and the one for it. And the, I mean, he's just drilled it into everyone's heads. I can even regurgitate it. And whereas you've got an Ackerson saying, all the idiots before me and the people who would check out, yeah, we've got future stuff that's coming that's okay. Mulally's not that at all. I mean, this is a guy that knows what leadership is about. I'm not convinced that Ackerson's got it. I know the people who work for him like him and they think he's doing the right thing. I don't think it reflects well in the rest of the industry or even deeper within GM. And I think Ackerson's big danger right now is Wall Street ain't buying what he's saying. You know, the stock's way down under the IPO price. Even though they sell more cars than Ford, they don't make nearly the kind of profit that Ford does. He better start changing things fast or the street's going to be all over him.
They got some good, and the thing, now here's the good news. They got some really good products.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I bought a Cruise for my daughter. It's exceptional.
Right.
The
yeah.
value.
Malibu was the number one selling passenger car in America last month. And now, I know there's certain circumstances that let them happen, i.e. the Camry and the Accord don't have enough volume. Nonetheless, Malibu outsold everything else
out there.
It's
not too late to fix the ship of what he's doing.
Right.
That's
no, I agree.
The bottom line.
Right.
He needs to learn.
Yeah, he's got to be
learned.
He's got to be careful.
Yeah.
I mean, he really has to be careful. I don't envy Selim Bingo's job at all. He's the head of GMPR because, you know, it's a tough job.
It is a tough job, but they can win this. But they got to know that, going to their war analogy, Ford is taking every advantage they can to
bury
them.
Well, first they've
got to
acknowledge they have a problem, right, before they can fix it. I don't see any of that kind of discussion going on at all. Not that I'm in the inner circle, but I just don't see GM recognizing that it's got a public relations problem right now.
No, it does. That was a pretty devastating interview.
Yeah, it was a real crap week, and it, you know, it was one thing that when it came out in a few circles, but now it's, you're seeing that reference of what he said about gasoline prices and so forth. So you got to get him in check and say, all right, let's talk about the good stuff, and let's be a little bit of humble pie.
Yeah.
Here. It is taxpayer money that saved the company.
Yeah, and don't denigrate your troops. I mean, the war announced. Don't, you know, these men and women work their asses off.
That's right.
All the time.
I've used this for 15 years now. Who invented the greatest anti-pollution device in the history of mankind?
General Motors.
General Motors. It wasn't Toyota. It wasn't Mercedes-Benz. It was
catalytic converter.
Yeah,
right?
The catalytic converter.
They didn't invent it, but they did figure out how to mass produce it.
They patented it.
Well, they did, but first article I ever read about a catalytic converter was dated from 1959. So, I mean, the idea was there.
Yeah, but they,
before
no,
GM
but wait,
got
they
there.
Went and they killed that guy, and then they took all the stuff, and then they developed.
Well, the visionary, too, behind that was Ed Cole. He was the one that said, we are going to do this.
And Bob Stemple was the guy who made it happen.
Yeah, we are going to do this, and we are going, and unleaded fuel's coming, and this is what we're going to do. And he pointed the corporation in that direction.
And speaking of other good GM news, now that we've crapped all over them, but Mark Royce came out at the end of last week saying, look, we're working on autonomous cars. Detroit is a city that really needs something to change its whole image. We should be putting autonomous cars on the streets of Detroit, developing the whole infrastructure and the technology there. And you guys know me. I'm a big proponent of autonomous cars.
He's talking about the
cars.
Envy, the little Envy.
The Envy, but it can go beyond.
Explain to
that.
Your viewers autonomous cars.
Well, autonomous cars are cars that can drive themselves. And you don't need a joystick, and you don't need somebody sitting at a control station. And guess what? You don't need 100% of all cars to have this technology. Autonomous cars can drive down the street. They can recognize if a pedestrian's crossing the street. They can tell if traffic's coming out. They can read stop signs and speed limit signs. I mean, they can drive all by themselves.
Well, eventually in urban centers around the world, you will approach the city limits and the master cylinder will take over. And you can sit there and read whatever, and you can put your destination in, because to keep the flow going, because by then Detroit will have the climate of Miami and we'll have
due to global warming.
Yeah. And you know, your car will get to the limits and you'll just, you know, press where you're going and it'll take over.
Now, what happens during carjackings?
Well, I don't know.
Well, your car never has to stop, so you won't get your carjacked.
It shoots the carjacker. Right. This is perfect.
Electrocutes them. Yeah.
You know, some people misinterpret when I criticize certain things about General Motors. I will never criticize the people who work their asses off to do great stuff and the true believers there that I always talk about, that I dedicated my Witch Hunt, my latest book, to the true believers in this business. And they're everywhere. They're at Chrysler, they're at GM, they're at Ford, they work hard. And my criticism of GM is never about those people. Mm-hmm. It's about questionable leadership tone and that sort of thing.
And I would say it's not just the Detroit, you know, three.
No,
it's the business,
it's
man.
The business.
Everybody, I don't care if you're in Korea or, you know, Germany or Japan,
yeah,
or China or what, everybody works their ass off in this business.
They do.
Hey, let's take a commercial break right now. We got some other topics we got to get back to, but right now we want to thank our sponsors from Bridgestone. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com.
Remember the early run flats? Harsh they were?
Oh, God, it was like running on steel wheels.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were harsh. But, yeah, these new ones are a whole lot better. Speaking of the news of the week, too, we saw a management shuffle at Chrysler. You know, I think the big news was really that Ralph Gilles will no longer run the Dodge brand and instead will start running a new position for SRT, Street Racing Technology Performance Vehicles. And I think the other big news is that Fred Diaz will now take over
Latin America and Mexico,
keep the Ram brand, but is no longer in charge of sales and marketing. And there's a guy who I've never met before. I don't even know this guy, Reed Bigland. Do any of you guys know this?
I know him really well. Ran Chrysler Canada.
Still does, I guess, too, because everybody gets two jobs.
Yeah, everybody has two jobs. Sergio is CEO and administrative assistant to Ralph Gilles. Reed's put in his time. He's a smart guy, very aggressive. I know the dealers like him a lot. Plus,
that wasn't a surprise to me. I mean, Ralph, you've got to be a dealer-oriented person, and I don't think that was Ralph's strong suit.
Yeah, but Ralph is a charmer, and
he's one
of the smartest guys I've ever worked with, one of the most talented guys. He gets to not only keep design, but he gets to recreate SRT.
I think it's a better thing for him.
Well, you know, people have said it's at best a sideways promotion, maybe even a demotion. I understand why people would say that.
No.
But I'd also say Ralph's the luckiest guy in the business to run design and performance vehicles.
He should recruit Anthony Weiner.
I still don't agree with the whole creating the Ram brand. I still think that's a waste.
I agree. I think it's
such
stupid.
A waste of time and money, and it's an example that Sergio just is too smart for himself.
You know? What else? Other Ram things are there going to be besides a pickup? The Ram. Okay.
Just total.
It was the glue for Dodge.
Total.
It's
over.
Ram tough and stuff like that. So why take it apart?
Total.
That's
over,
where Dodge is suffering right now. You got a wonderful Durango, which is I love that. Vehicle. That's candy
vehicle.
On the
really
highway.
Good. Right.
And then you got, what else? You got the Grand Caravan, a great vehicle for what it does, but you get this mishmash, and Dodge is lost right now as a brand.
That was a huge error.
That
huge.
Yeah, it just was right.
And it's not going to get better, too.
It's
going to keep going down,
right,
till someone says, you know, maybe that was a bad idea.
Because you could go into a Dodge store to buy a Ram, because you need it for your work or whatever, and another member of your family might buy another Dodge vehicle because you like the dealer and so forth. Now, why have you separated that? That was cockiness. The fact, though, I'm really excited about my friends there. The fact that they're bringing SRT back, it shows they're really getting getting their sea legs back. It was really one of the neat parts about Chrysler in the last part of the middle part of the last decade with the SRT4. Finally, the Neon was a cool vehicle.
It was.
It was a lot of fun to drive.
It was a lot of fun. I'm bang for the buck. It was awesome.
And the I had a Charger SRT8, the Grand Cherokee SRT8, ridiculously stupid, great vehicle. So that just shows a little chutzpah and a love of the automobile again.
See, what I'm reading into these changes is, you know, Chrysler sales are up almost 20% this year, and they've gained a few tenths of market share, all to the good. But they're not to the target that Sergio had set. Well, you know, he set these overly ambitious targets, I think. But the real danger I'm reading into Chrysler sales right now is it's all in pickups, SUVs, and Jeeps. Their cars are dead in the water. The 200 is the best-selling car that Chrysler has right now. It's doing okay. The rest of them are not even doing okay, which shocks me because I think the new 300 is a terrific car.
I think it's gorgeous.
Terrific car. It's dead in the water, and I think this is why Sergio's making these changes. Is he went, wait a minute, you know, we did all these redesigns, and they've fallen flat.
Well, that's the one.
It can't be a product problem.
Well, I was very high and wrote on the MichiganView.com when there was a debate on the M&M ad. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't care how much it cost. They got so much buzz and so much talk. It was the wrong car. It should have been the 300.
Mm-hmm.
So they're selling quite a few 200s now. They don't make that much money on them, and that's going to dwindle once people find out it's a gussied up Sebring.
It's not that bad of a car, but there's a lot of other really
still,
good stuff out there.
The 300 is still the flagship and still a hell of a bargain. And that is the attitude of Detroit and the attitude of Chrysler. And I think they blew it there in a wonderful display that is paying off now, but it could have been even better.
Well, the one thing I want to know, because I don't get access to fleet versus retail sales, you know, they've talked about throttling back on fleet sales. Does that explain why their cars are not selling as well? I'm not sure what's going on here, but I really believe this is why Sergio shuffled the deck with their executives, why Ralph was moved into performance, this Reed Biglin has moved in to run sales right now, and Dodge, because if they don't get their passenger car sales up, they are dead in the water. This thing's not going to work.
It's still, yeah, Chrysler's it's kind of the golden child again, kind of, you know, but the other guys are doing really well, especially Ford. This may be a faint moment for them, I don't know, but they've got to put the pedal to the metal and just not have a few good months, because remember, they're comparing months to really awful months a year ago and to 2 years ago when they were dead. Just dead. And their fleet sales were 35%.
If not more.
If not more. And they were on death's door.
Right. Speaking of Ford, they dropped a bombshell today. You know, they talked about bringing the C-Max to the U.S. market. It's already launched in Europe. Actually, we were going to get the Grand C-Max, the 7-passenger with the sliding doors. I was, you know, at the Ford presser for the launch of that in Europe, and they told us how, oh, we can't bring the 5-passenger to America. America needs the bigger one, and blah, blah, blah. And then today they dropped the bombshell. No, they're not going to bring the 7-passenger here at all. They're only going to have the 5-passenger. And, by the way, it will only be sold as a hybrid.
Yeah, that was huge. Huge news.
What do you think's going on there? Why hybrid only?
Well, I think the reality of the new mileage standards is really starting to hit. I mean, we've talked about it, but I don't think consumers really get it. And I think they thought about it, and they weighed it, and they just said, well, hell with it. We're just going hybrid because we're going to eventually be there anyway. So let's just jump, let's skip a couple years and just bring it in that way.
What I'm reading into it
you
is...
You rode in one when you were in...
No, it's a cool car. I rode in both the 5 and the 7 passenger, EcoBoost and diesel, manual and automatic. So, yeah, I'm very familiar with the vehicle. But what I'm reading into it is this. I think Ford recognizes, hey, Toyota's flat dead in the water right now because of the inventory issue. Sales of the Prius have absolutely tanked. They've fallen in half, not through lack of demand. They just don't have the cars to sell. Ford also recognizes that no one's matched the success of the Prius, not even Toyota. I mean, Toyota sells all kinds of hybrids. They don't sell very well. Only the Prius does. One of the reasons everybody thinks the Prius does well is it's a dedicated hybrid car. It looks different than anything else out there. You can't buy anything but a hybrid Prius. That's what it is. So my guess is Ford's thinking, you know, we're really starting to get our message across that we've got good fuel economy. We got to do our own Prius. If we're going to be believed by the skeptics, by the environmentalists, by the people who buy Priuses right now, if they're going to consider us at all, we got to do the same thing Toyota did. Ergo, we're going to come out with a hybrid, and it's going to look different, and that's all you can buy it as, is a hybrid, and by the way, a plug-in hybrid. And I think when they looked at that, they probably went, you know what, if we do the 7-passenger version, it's not going to have that great a fuel economy. So let's do the 5-passenger. You take out the sliding doors, that cuts cost, because remember, this is going to be their lithium-ion hybrid.
Sliding doors are heavier in hell.
Heavier, and it adds a lot of cost. So my guess is this whole thing has been driven by, let's make Ford really look like a fuel economy leader, and I believe that's what's changed everything. The thing that I find astonishing, though, is, like I said, they laid out their whole launch and marketing plans for me a year and a half ago, and it was all based on the 7-door. They threw all that out the window, and, you know, it's a very risky move, but I really admire them for spinning on a dime and really rolling the dice. I think it may not work at all. I'm very skeptical about hybrids, but I admire the risk that they're taking.
And they also said it's going to get better mileage than the Fusion hybrid.
Right, right.
You know, to use the war analogy that we don't like to use, what it is Toyota's reloading. Okay, they're in the bunker reloading. These guys decided to come over the thing and just start shooting and expend a lot of ammo, which is, look what Toyota did with the Prius. And being on the domestic side, we bitched and moaned that they were losing $4,000 on every car in those first 3 or 4 years. They're just throwing these things at the market. They're losing money. Well, it was brilliance on their part because they established this. It was marketing money.
Right.
And then they finally started to make some. Ford can do that, too. They'll probably lose money a little bit, but they'll establish a beachhead on that they're a fuel economy leader. And they're out there while Toyota is suffering from the disaster of the tsunami, and so is Nissan and everybody else. So now's the time to step on the pedal. Ford's doing it. Beware Toyota. Beware GM. And GM needs to step on the pedal, too. You need to take it, you know, for all the disaster and the human suffrage, what happened to Japan, this is a cutthroat industry. Take advantage of it now, and let's see what happens. And you know, Ford has passed Toyota in perception, which is marvelous.
Well,
because of their good products and Toyota's fall with their disaster, the crisis of their sudden acceleration issue, and now what's happening to their actual production.
Toyota's been hurt, but don't count them out anyway at all. Because as you know, you were at Ford a decade ago when Ford was upside down. Literally, the Explorers were upside down, and everybody.
Thank you for reminding me.
Just in case you had forgotten, Jason. So, I mean, Toyota will come back.
Absolutely.
You can't write them out. Hey, look, let's take another commercial break here, and then we got to get our guest, Francois Castaing, to get up here with us. But, Ben, we've got to do that, and right now I'd like to thank our great sponsors at Hyundai. With gas prices where they are these days, if you're after fuel efficiency, you need to check out the Hyundai Sonata. There's three different models to choose from. The 2.4-liter GDI, which delivers a segment-leading 35 miles per gallon. Then there's the 2-liter turbo, which offers 274 horsepower, yet delivers 33 miles per gallon. And the brand new hybrid that provides a combined 37 miles per gallon. And you can learn a lot more about each one at HyundaiSonata.com. Well, it's great to have our guest here in the studio with us, Francois Castaing. Francois, great having you here with us on Autoline After Hours.
Thank you for inviting me to be here.
And we got to give everybody a little bit of a background to Francois. He had been the vice president of engineering at Chrysler back when Chrysler was making boatloads of money and was really rocking.
Executive vice president.
Executive vice president, excuse me. And he ended up at Chrysler because Chrysler bought American Motors, and you were the head of engineering there, is that right?
Yes.
And then the reason you were at American Motors, of course, is because Renault had bought it, and you actually started your automotive career at Renault. Is that right?
Absolutely.
I wasn't sure if there was anything before Renault.
Well, there was. I always been passionate about automobile. Initially, racing cars was my passion when I was growing up, and I was lucky enough to get a good degree in engineering, and be recruited as a miracle by Mr. Gordini, a famous figure.
Gordini, yeah.
Gordini in the 50s and so on. And he was at the end of his career working for Renault as a subcontractor doing a racing engine to permit Renault Alpine to race at Le Mans without too much success back then. And Renault, in 1968, when I joined Mr. Gordini, having done a thesis for him when I was in college, my last year designed a race car for him. And appreciate.
That's your college thesis, is designing a race car?
Yeah, I was two
That's
colleagues.
Good.
We made a wind tunnel models, and we provided him with the blueprint of the car. And I thought he apparently liked me, so I went to ask him if he would recruit me, and he said yes. So immediately I was on a drafting board adapting his engine to fuel injection, which was to him a mystery because he was a carburetor guy. Then I left for doing some time in my military obligation, like most French at the time. And when I came back, Gordini has been bought out. Renault now, I created a new company called Renault Gordini in a new factory out south of Paris. And then another engineer, John, a degreed engineer, had joined me, Jean-Pierre Boudy. And soon after that, Renault said, why don't we give you a chance to see if you can do something? Elf is pushing us to do a real racing engine, a modern one. Would you design a 2-liter V6 for us? And we said, yes, oh, yeah. And we did it, and it worked. And in 72, we bought this little engine to the market and started winning races with that all over Europe. And
hey, Ben, I think we got a picture of Francois in 72, that black and white one. Let's bring that one up on the screen. But this engine didn't just stop there. You kept evolving it.
This engine put Renault Sport back to on the winning path. So we won European Championship and then started turbocharging the engine and fighting Porsche and Alphas in the 70s and starting winning races. We didn't win the world championship, but we were close. And then Renault insisted that we try to win Le Mans, which we did in 78, which was a big deal and a lot of work. And then in the meantime, we figured that if we were to downsize the engine a little bit to 1.5 liter and put a big turbocharger on it, maybe we had a chance of being in Formula One. And all the pundits at the time, the chief engineer at Porsche and Keith Duckworth, said it will never work on pump fuel. At the time, we were using regular 100-octane fuel, and it never going to work. And we made it work. And so,
and this is when everybody was using naturally aspirated 3-liter engines, but the rules would allow a 1.5-liter turbo, and you were the first one to take advantage of that.
Since the 60s or before that, and nobody thought it was going to work. But we made it work. At the end, we didn't know what was impossible, so we tried them. But it was, at the time, it sounded like a very tough challenge. And along the way, some of my colleagues at Renault were saying, we made a mistake to let you get in that direction. But day for the day, we did our first race. Not only we built the engine, by that time, I was the chief engineer of Renault Sport, the entire organization.
So you're running the whole F1 operation.
Le Mans, everything. And as we are preparing Le Mans, we put together a Formula One team from the ground up doing its own transmission, engine, body, chassis, everything. And we were now on the level of Ferrari, if you wish, in competition. And by the way, we are the two non-British teams, so we would park our trailer next to each other and have our chef exchange recipes because we wanted to be the best fed F1 team. But long story short, we had our first outing with the car and the turbo engine in Silverstone in July of 77, and we won the first Grand Prix in July of 79. So 24 months was, in the world for people who have been involved in Formula One, going from nothing to winning the first Grand Prix, and in the meantime putting Formula One upside down, because the next year everybody wanted to have a turbo and got a turbo. So that was my learning curve in my engineering life. And then we decided with my wife that maybe it was time for us to see to do something maybe that was not as not narrow-minded, but you are in a bubble when you are in motorsport. And Renault asked me if I would be interested in moving to Detroit to be a part of the new adventure with AMC. It was in the middle of the oil crisis, and AMC needed small cars. The famous AMC Renault little cars were born because I came to Detroit with the blueprint of the car.
This would be the Alliance?
Yeah, the Alliance, yeah.
The Renault Alliance, right. Or the AMC Alliance, I guess AMC I should Alliance. Say.
And so, no, it was the Renault Alliance, in fact. We were filling them under that name. Mm. And then I learned, I went from having an organization that had like 150 people to being involved in a much bigger organization. I was blessed that I was adopted by the AMC engineers, especially Roy Lund.
And Roy Lund, we should explain, too, also had a great racing background. He's the guy who did the GT40s for Ford at Le Mans.
Yeah, absolutely. And Roy adopted me and under his wing. And soon I was involved in helping create the first new Jeep, the Cherokee, with a smaller engine and a smaller body. And I was an active participant in that. And then sooner after that, the AMC situation became worse. Renault pumped more money, became a majority owner. And I was asked to succeed Roy Lund in a way, so which I did. And then we ended up making the Cherokee even better. Some people said it's the real sport utility craze started with the day we put a nice inline six inside and a Toyota transmission and painted the thing black with gold stripe and nice wheels. Mm-hmm. And it became an
instant hit. Right.
And at the time, I didn't think that we were committing a crime for creating a sport utility.
In 1992, I think Chrysler made $1 billion. Jeep made $2
billion. Wow.
Everything else lost money, thanks to what became the Grand Cherokee.
Yeah.
Which these guys started at AMC.
Well, then Chrysler bought AMC.
Yeah. So and Renault changed his mind. There was the death of Mr. Best, the chairman who had been supportive of that, of the deal within the U.S., which in retrospect, strategically, would have been wonderful for Renault to stick to it. Mm-hmm. But politics and union issues left Renault, the successor, Mr. Best, Mr. Levy, to make like two not well thought out decision to try to get rid of AMC. And Iacocca and Steve Miller were there in the weed waiting for that. And over a weekend we were sold. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, it was a blessing for us. Me and my family, and I was at the end asked to go back to Renault, and I didn't want to go. And Chrysler thought I could help them, so it turned out for the best.
It did, because you guys transformed Chrysler. That's when you really instituted this whole concept that you called platform engineering.
Right.
And it absolutely transformed Chrysler.
It wasn't platform engineering. It was platform teams.
Teams.
Because yeah. Right. It included everybody from all the disciplines.
Right. Cross-discipline approach to product development, which I thought was genius, and I still don't know why everybody just doesn't copy that to this day.
Well, it's been inspiring people. They don't do it exactly the same way, but it still made people realize that if you look, I'm sure you read the book Good to Great, and Good to Great has documented successful companies that have done better than good, and in most cases, all cases, the main reason why they became great is because they created a culture where people felt motivated in accomplishing themselves for the good of the company, but within understanding the limits of how much risk they were to take. And in fact, the platform team or the platform culture was about that, putting a group of engineers to do the new large cars in a different building and putting people together that they will create their own little company and picking the right people to do that and giving them a mission, a cost target, an investment target, letting them talk to the customer and not going through a group doing research for them and so on. And overnight, the LH were born, and it was a tough time at the time. We were in crisis, still starting losing cash every day. And the Lashkar, the LHs, were born in a year less than any other crisis. We gained 1 year out of the schedule. Even it was just trying, just doing bad. And people were happier. The cost of the car, the investment was much respected. We spent less than we were given the chance to spend. And the car went not too bad. They sold. So
company made a lot of money. I think total sales got up to like 3.5 million thereabouts. It was over 3 million units. Total vehicle sales.
By around 96 with the new Ram and the LHs and so forth. Right. Yeah.
And then we understood the continuous improvement. So every team, you know, engineers, manufacturing people, the suppliers who are working with us now in the new tech center, which was really cut by, not by specialty, but by group doing cars. You could come one day and see people signing a body in white in the hallway, and people were signing their first prototype like a baby. They were a real change of culture. When I came to Chrysler, I wanted to go to the proving ground, and I said, well, to drive at the proving ground, you need to have a special permit. And I said, well, how about that? Well, and we have a rule at Chrysler that to not to have any accident, and I think you have to have a permit. So, and then they say there's a speed limit at the proving ground. You cannot exceed 60 miles an hour. So I said, this is a strange way of testing cars. And then one day a guy called me from one of our... We were testing Jeep in Arizona at the Chrysler Proving Ground there. And I received a phone call from the manager of the Proving Ground saying that you are in charge of these Jeep engineers. They are leaving black mark on the pad. I said, well, that's what they're supposed to do. Just slide on the pad. You know what? We've never done that. I don't know that it's permitted to leave black mark. Are they going to remove them?
Tell them about remember the Chrysler hole? Remember that plaque you had about the Chrysler hole?
Yeah, the culture of Chrysler was kind of interesting. They had fallen in love with the concept that the reason to really make money in the business, they will have only one type of front-wheel drive system called the K car. And this car will be made out of, like computers today, you buy... the memory from high volume memory from a given supplier, so you get a low cost, and you buy other parts of the computer this way. And they have this vision that they created a culture that they had this technical group or whatever it was, or business group, that we are dealing with the chunk of the car like a commodity. Most of them were hourly engineers, and the engineers were just there to release this part to make a car. So the car, there's not a secret that the K cars were never looking completely together. One day, I was still in charge only of Jeep initially and trucks. We had this, someone wanted to get into our staff meeting on Monday morning. And he introduced himself. He said, you know, I know that this is not the subject of a meeting, but there's something very important I need to share with you. So I said, well, okay, go ahead. Tell us what you are. I am such and such, and I'm the manager of the common hall cluster. So I said, well, so what is that? Well, I'm in charge of clusters, and I figure that if we can make the same hall and everybody... And we could use one cluster that will go in everything. And I just look at your Jeep, and they have different hole. And so we're almost cracking. So we look like that all around the table. So that's interesting. And, well, we're going to think about it. And I don't know if people care that, you know, that the same thing will go in every car. So we thank him. So, okay, we're going to think about it. So the next day, one of my guys... took a piece of hardwood and make a hole into it and put it to the glory of this meeting.
A common hole.
Common hole.
That's pretty good.
Anyway, but in retrospect, you know, I was blessed to come at the right time, a little bit with like Gordini, being, you know, being at the right time and people having a need for doing something. And initially, there was an act of faith on the part of Bob Lutz to let me transform a chunk of the company this way. We were under pressure of, you know, financial duress in the company. But I said, well, if you want to do things different, you have to be faster. You have to get more people motivated, more risk takers. Engineers should design cars, not paper pusher or planners and so on. And it worked. And
it worked so well.
He's being kind, though. It was initially the old guard at Chrysler. They were like, yeah. The engineer from AMC? Give me a break. And it was rough sledding for a little while, but then they realized that he was making a difference immediately.
It was a campaign of bad letters and
stuff. Oh, yes.
Well, there was quite a few AMC executives did really well in the Chrysler organization. And I remember Lutz saying at one point that, to your point, Jason, a lot of the Chrysler people's attitude was, wait a minute, we bought them. Yeah.
Well, Gwendon, remember the cartoonist?
Yeah.
At the time of the at the sale, he had a cartoon where all these AMC designers are sitting around with the gremlin and stuff on the back going, how can they break up a great design team like this? But that's...
On the other hand, I think, talk about the Mulally and what is done with the same people at Ford. Mm-hmm. I was convinced that I grew in Europe at the time where Chrysler engineers were as respected as Mercedes engineers for their car they have done since the 1930s or before and so on. And I remember saying at one of my first meetings when I became the head of all the engineers at Chrysler, I was brave enough to have a meeting at the Masonic Temple to have thousands of my people. I was by myself on stage. And I talked to them very bluntly about the fact that I had a huge respect for them, and right now, the more I was listening around the world, they were not getting any respect. So I said, humbly, I'm going to try to work with you so we're going to get back that respect. So that created some, you know, people applauded that. Others saying, well, who is to tell us that we are not respectable, we're not respected? But that was the real. But it was not them, it's the fact their system. And them accepted the fact that they weren't letting other people run their business. And part of turning around Chrysler products were to get the engineers to give their best, to be motivated, designing good cars. And if it was not perfect initially because you get the machine was a little rusted, but it turned around, so.
Yeah, well, you know, it worked so well that that's why Daimler came and wanted to take over Chrysler. And as soon as that happened, it all started to unravel. I mean, it took a few years, but it completely unraveled. And that's why I say I can't believe why everybody doesn't go back to that same platform, cross-functional approach. I thought it was brilliant.
Well, it's it requires intense leadership, though, because it's not something that can be you cannot create a culture like that. And just put it in a manual and say that is work. You have every day to, because it's a matrix organization, you have to always to try to make sure people are at the right balance. Uh-huh. You want a team that design an automobile to be as inventive and customer-driven as possible, but you don't want the people to reinvent something for the sake of reinventing where there's another car next to it that is doing already a good job at doing that. So it requires, you know, a lot of attention. Clearly, after I was moved to other assignment, some of this leadership changed, and some of the good things that the system was doing were started to be lost. And so, at the end, regardless of which system you use, takes take some leadership to make sure it works well.
Mm-hmm. There was only one organization that was initially in the platform team that didn't want to be a part of it. It was marketing early on.
Yeah.
They fought it. Everybody else was, yeah, this is awesome. And so the head of marketing was, and then marketing came on board. So it was a complete team from every organization was on the platform team.
Mm-hmm. Francois, you know, you were heavily involved in Le Mans and Renault's initial effort in there. And Peter, you've just turned me on to something, too, a new American effort at getting back to Le Mans. Tell us a bit about
that. Well, the Delta Wing concept, which was first proposed a year and a half ago for the 2012 IndyCar rules, was this radical approach.
Really cool-looking car.
Really cool-looking car, based on lighter weight, more efficient four-cylinder turbo engine. And, you know, it was too radical for IndyCar. They didn't adapt it. It was part of one of the chassis that were proposed for IndyCar to become the IndyCar. Now, I've talked to Randy Bernard at IndyCar, so you should find a place for the Delta Wing anyway. Let the thing run, you know, in 2012 anyway. Well, subsequently, Duncan Dayton from Highcroft Racing, who won the ALMS championship back-to-back years with the Acura team, hooked up with Ben Balbi, the designer of the Delta Wing, and they've adapted the Delta Wing concept for sports car racing, for Le Mans prototype racing. And they just announced formally that the ACO, the organizers of the Le Mans, will allow them to bring the Delta Wing sports prototype to Le Mans 2012. They call it the 56th Garage, which allows for some forward-thinking design. It's sort of an unclassified entry, but it is an official entry. There it is there.
On the screen, yeah.
Adapted for prototype racing. And Dan Gurney is always inquisitive and you know, one of the greats, all-time greats in racing and a designer and engineer. Or, you know, he's very much in tune to engineering and advanced concepts. And he's embracing this. And so they have been official. They've got an official entry for 2012. They don't have an engine manufacturer as of yet. And, you know, I was talking to Duncan about this, and I said, if you're going to get the approval from the ACO, then make the announcement. There will be a manufacturer. Clearly, Dan Gurney would like to see an American manufacturer give them an engine and support the program. But, you know, time's a-wasting, so a engine manufacturer, I'm sure, is going to sign up for this program. And it's fascinating because, you know, their computer simulations for this car is it will be every bit as quick as the Peugeots and Audi diesels and get better mileage. I mean, they're not diesels, but, you know, four-cylinder direct-injected turbo with about 325 horsepower, they can lap Le Mans as quick as the Audis and Peugeots. And it's lighter weight, more aerodynamic, more efficient. It's a fascinating deal, and I'd love to see an American engine or manufacturer.
Yeah, no kidding.
Throw their weight into the program. And I'm sure Francois is intrigued by it, too.
Well, Francois, you had an intriguing concept that you wanted Chrysler to take to Le Mans.
Yeah.
Turbine flywheel.
Right.
The Patriot.
Where it was the time where we had engaged ourselves with and my colleagues at Ford and GM working with the government through the famous PNGV collaboration. Trying to define what was feasible for fuel efficiency in the future. And frankly speaking, our study that we did together with the help of the national labs and other distinguished government agency are still valid today, that whether we talk about performance, cost, manufacturability, and so on, we build prototype that we're doing 85 per man, you know, mid-size or almost full-size cars that were giving 85 miles per gallon, but they were not affordable. They were there, and anyway, but at the time, out of the blue, we thought about doing something extremely out of the box. That's the big time out of the box was to be natural gas fueled twin turbine alternator powered big hybrid with a flywheel. It's called the Patriot. And in retrospect, maybe we this was kind of moonshot. That was even was longer, maybe worse than the moonshot, but more difficult than the moonshot. But it really opened the mind of a lot of people, and including all the way to President Clinton, who took me aside one day in Washington and said, "I want to come with you to Paris, to Le Mans, to see what we do with your car." And but we find out, which others have found since, that the flywheel accumulator of energy are a good idea, but extremely dangerous for. They work well in satellites in
vacuum of space, right?
And when they are not spinning too fast, but ours were spinning at 75,000 RPM, and coming down and spinning up as soon as you were using the energy. But anyway, so we learn a lot, like always with experiment. They also open the mind of the Chrysler engineers to think out of the box.
And here we are, what? Maybe not 20 years later, but
15, 16
years later, Porsche's got a flywheel car. Not quite the same turbine thing, but using flywheel for energy accumulator.
Yeah. Well, the Formula One, the famous Formula One teams were very proud of reinventing what they call CARES, which is the kinetic energy recovery device, which they are using, which is most of the time a big battery with a little motor. But and they, but yeah, we thought about that. It was a fun project. And our next one was doing a car for China, you know, opposite side of the CCV. And it was made in molded resin.
Super low cost car.
Yeah, was the car that.
And the body was made by a trash company, the guy that made trash bins in Western Michigan, right?
Right. We look for molders. We're having a molding machine big enough to do half a car, and we find the people were doing that. We're doing trash big things, and we partner with this company in Grand Rapids and others around. And it was a fascinating project. I have more regret about this one of being disappeared.
Sure, you would have had the Tata Nano years before Tata came along.
Mr. Tata recognized that we were an inspiration for them. So
1997 or something like that, because we showed the vehicle out in Auburn Hills in the press room.
No, I remember seeing the car. It was really cool. In fact, I know you studied the Citroën de Chevaux for inspiration low-cost
design.
Because
it was my first car, the Chevaux. And I was talking to my people and said, you know, we're going to do a new De Chevaux. And they look at me like I'm talking about Hebrew. And I said, it's after the war. I explained that the French and had no money. They were moving up for motorcycle. So small cars were created for them at a low cost and low weight. They still didn't get it. And so we bought one, shipped it. And so they weighted the car the first day, and it was half the weight of the Neon. And therefore, probably half the cost of the Neon, which at the time was a low-cost car. And I said, well, why don't we reinvent the De Chevaux with modern materials, with the same spec and the same weight objective, so that the way the car was born.
Unfortunately, a custodian at Chrysler one night saw the prototype and put it out on the curb for the maintenance workers to pick up the trash, and it was thrown away.
Hey, but back to the Delta Wing. So you think we'll see that at Le Mans next year then?
Oh, we'll see it at Le Mans. It's just a question of which manufacturer will affiliate with the program.
Yeah, as the engine provider.
As the engine provider.
And are they talking with some of the manufacturers?
Yeah, they're talking, and you know, Dan Gurney's involved, so when Dan's involved, people listen.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So,
hey, let's take another quick commercial break, and then let's get to rapid fire. I'm dying to get to some of the questions. But, Ben, let's thank our friends at Chevrolet. The Chevrolet Cruze is the car that is taking the world by storm, and a key reason is all the equipment that it offers. A driver information center, a USB port, ambient LED backlighting on the dashboard, remote start with a MyLink app, two accessory power outlets, one in front and one in the back for the rear passengers, OnStar turn-by-turn directions free for the first 6 months. Whew, there's just too much to list here. And you can check it all out at Chevrolet.com/cruise. Okay, it's time for a rapid fire. Ben, let's launch it. Okay, Francois, this is where we try to get through a bunch of questions as fast as we can. Unsprung wants to know, why is GM trying to sell Opel now? If they are, that's the rumor out there that came out of the German media.
So can't make any money on it.
Can't make any money. That's the answer, exactly. Dr. Botox wants to know, he says, anybody notice that Chinese car sales were off last month? Isn't China supposed to be the future for everybody? What if everyone's wrong? We talked about this last show, Peter. I'm saying I think the industry is way overbuilt in China. I know everyone's talking that the sales should go to 20 million and 30 million a year, and I don't think it's going to happen.
Don't judge by 1 month anyway.
I know. Sean P. Walsh says, question for all of you, but especially for Jason, the PR guy. What's the story on your county executive, Robert Ficano, spending money on ads here in the D.C. area, on ads promoting the auto bailout as a great success? Is this a publicity stunt to get reelected?
No, it's not a publicity stunt to get reelected because nobody in Washington votes for Ficano. Quite frankly, that's news to me.
Yeah, I hadn't heard.
And I can't believe he's wasting money advertising.
Well, he's been running those ads here, and it's a waste of money here.
I was in Aruba 2 years ago, and they were doing pure Michigan ads. I'm going, who in Aruba wants to care about this? I don't know why these guys do this stuff.
It's an ego play, it's just, you know.
Danny Boy Lost in Ohio says, men, yeah, baby Delta Wing Indy cars for next year, ? Now let's get different engines in them. Ford, Chevy, Porsche, Eco Motors, a diesel, and a boogity-boogity. Let's go racing, boys. Any comments?
Well, you know, the one thing the Delta Wing project needed was legitimacy. They haven't now. The ACO is welcoming them for next year's race. So all of a sudden, the Delta Wing is no longer just a proposal. It's a real thing. So it's going to be very interesting.
Here's a comment from a guest who says, I don't want to be an ass, but shouldn't everyone be at least in business casual? He says it would give the show a more polished look. A lot of viewers here are in the industry, and they're already at work in Southeast Asia and Australia and New Zealand.
Yes, he's right. He is an ass.
It's after hours here, man.
That's right.
Call it after hours.
Jeff C. says, if Ford's going to race at Le Mans, they have to start racing in the American Le Mans Series first. It helps to have a car that can compete in the ALMS. The GT40 is over, been there, done that. The Shelby 427 Cobra, purposely built as a Corvette killer, done. That leaves the Mustang, that's their page jump here. Great White Hope, move the tranny to the rear, build a two-seat sports car to go. Well, anyway, this guy goes on and on.
I mean, the Mustang is a brick. That's why you don't see the Mustang in GT2 and the ALMS. And, you know, Ford won Le Mans for the first time in 1966, and then they won it 4 years in a row, and the most famous being when Gurney and Foyt won. The 50th anniversary of Ford winning Le Mans for the first time is 2016. So, believe me, it's on their radar.
That would be so cool for
but,
them to get back.
You know, somebody like Ford with that legacy, you don't show up and run seconds. If you're going to show up, you better win it.
You better be there to win.
Yeah,
who knows what happens in racing,
yeah,
but you better be there to win.
The whole focus of the program is to win.
Right. So. Hey, we've got some phone calls coming in. Ben, let's get to the first one.
Hi, Peter and John. This is Auto Freelancer out of New Jersey. This is a question for Autoline After Hours. You guys have a great show, and I have a two-part question for you. First, what's your thoughts on planned obsolescence within the current automotive industry? And second is, what automobile companies do this to lease nowadays, or not at all? Thanks, guys.
Well, that's a good question, actually. It's not planned obsolescence anymore like it was in the 1960s, where, you know, look, if a car had 50,000 miles on it, you started thinking about buying a new one because it was rusting out and blowing blue smoke. I don't think there is planned obsolescence in the sense that cars today will go 200, 250, 270,000 miles. I mean, it's incredible how long they'll last. But there's no question The newest stuff sells the best. And if you can be updating your product, man, it does make a difference.
For all That's the warts that the auto industry gets and all the slams, planned obsolescence is in other industries now. It's in the video games, which are old after 6 months.
The phone business.
The phone business and appliances like refrigerators that now last 5 years when refrigerators used to last 40 years.
Right.
So good news for the auto industry. They've built these things to last and last forever if you want to keep them. So give them some kudos for once.
Yep.
Ben, let's bring in another phone call.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. My question for the panel is, with the small size and limited success in NASCAR, should Chrysler pull out and use that money on other motorsports programs that would give them more bang for the buck? Thanks.
I can safely say that Chrysler isn't going to pull out of NASCAR, not with its current regime.
No, right. I think they should.
I don't know. If Chrysler doesn't do NASCAR, I don't know what they would do. Really.
Yeah, because they're not going to do Indy. They're not going to do Formula One. And now with the rebirth of the SRT, it's an ability to advertise to those folks. So
now stay tuned, because NASCAR is going to do some things different in the next couple of years.
So maybe keeping the Challenger around would be good for NASCAR?
Well, yeah, I think you're going to see some different things in Sprint Cup, but you're going to see a different approach altogether for NASCAR. Mm. Totally different kind of racing.
Mm. Well, Dodge is getting involved in drag racing, and I think that is a smart move for it to do so, and Mopar. But Francois, what would you do if you were back at Chrysler with motorsports?
Go to Le Mans.
Well, in my days, I resisted the push to go back to NASCAR. Chrysler's been away, and the rationale for not being interested in was actually a survey we did whether or not it was changing sales. You know, the famous things, if you win on Sunday, you sell on Monday. So we did an extensive survey, and it was not true anymore. And the cars at the time, GM and Ford, were racing there, were dead in the marketplace anyway. Secondly, NASCAR has evolved in some way that is still a big show, and I respect that. But you have to pay a lot of money to be a rolling billboard, and you are never advertised. The people that are on you are the one making it. So there is very little return. The name of your car is rarely known. It's the number of the car is what they use all the time. So you are paying to be a running billboard for somebody, you know, advertise on you. And I think it's true today. And I know that even in the company today, all of them, the four that are involved, there's constantly people asking the question, are you sure that we should want to continue to do that?
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. And, you know, we've talked a lot about that, that it's a spec series. Mm-hmm. You know, the cars all look the same. They have to put decals of the headlamps and the grill to give them some sort of
cult of personality series. Mm-hmm. First, it's the driver, it's the team sponsor, it's the race sponsor.
And the number, like Francois.
And the number. And, oh, by the way, my Ford run real good today.
Yeah.
But, you know, NASCAR is under the gun, and they are embracing change, and they have to change. My recommendation for Sprint Cup is go to stock dimension body cars, put all the safety stuff in it, run the Challenger, the Mustang, the Camaro. Mm-hmm. This thing about running Impalas and whatever they call them, and the car tomorrow was the death knell for NASCAR. It was a huge error.
It was a bad idea.
Yeah, a horribly bad idea. And they have to change that, and they've got to change it as fast as they can.
Yeah.
And I would.
You talked earlier about Toyota, and I learned one day from colleagues of mine at Toyota that they made this hard decision, but good decision, to go NASCAR. And I said, well, you are going to start declining from that point on. I saw that as a major strategic mistake, where the good rationale from the companies, especially in Japan, will be, in fact, giving, they listen too much to what be the people representing their dealers in the U.S. who wanted to go there, because it's good to be a dealer and to be around the track and so on. But it does not sell cars, and certainly not, it does not enhance the reputation of your technology. Hmm. It does not, nothing of that.
Yeah, there's no connection. There's no connection.
Ben, I think we got another phoner. Let's bring it in.
Hi there. Dan Smith from Durham, North Carolina. I happen to think that Volkswagen Group is running from the Subaru WRX STI like their pants are on fire. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, if they build a car that's price competitive with the Subaru, their car is pretty much roadkill. But if they build one that's competitive on every count, including performance, then they end up with a car that's ridiculously expensive and nobody wants to buy it. If you'll notice, none of their hat is directly competitive with the Subaru product. Thank you. Have a good day.
Well, he makes a good point. I mean, Volkswagen doesn't have anything that really goes up against the WRX from Subaru.
Yeah, but here's a question. Would you miss it? Mm-hmm. I mean, Volkswagen has clearly laid out their goal here. They lowered the Jetta price mm-hmm. point. They're bringing this Passat in. They don't care about it.
No, they don't. But wouldn't it be great to have a killer GTI or even a modern-day Scirocco come back? I think it'd be cool.
I think the GTI is great right now for an everyday car.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think of the Jetta?
I just
think it's so vanilla now.
The new Jetta, I mean, you know, if you option up the Jetta, it's what a Jetta should be. If you go into the dealer and get the $16,000 one, it's boredom on wheels mm-hmm. to sleep at the wheel. I mean, let's face it, the Subaru, that's a niche. It's cool. But, you know, not every manufacturer needs to be there.
Yeah. Well, look, we ought to wrap it up here. But Francois Castaing, before we do go, we got to talk about your involvement with the Detroit Science mm-hmm. Center, because it's been awesome what you've done there. You've taken sort of a science center / museum kind of a thing, really built it up into something, all with the idea of getting kids really interested in math and science. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when I left Chrysler in 1998, just before the invasion.
French are really sensitive to German invasions.
I thought it was a bad idea. Anyway, I had plenty of energy and time, and one thing that I'd been passionate about was to convince young people to enjoy the life that I had the good fortune to be living. And it was clear at the time already, some of us had been commiserating about the lack of interest by young people and their family in career and engineering. So I was looking for at least doing two or three things in that field. One of them was in Detroit, as I looked for a place to spend my energy, someone said, you should do something in Detroit. There's this Midtown area, and there's only one institution that has been without a leader or someone to look after them. So I paid them a visit, and I was convinced it was a terrible place. It was small. It was raining inside. You had only 12 people working there. But I saw the yellow bus coming in, the truck, the school bus, dropping kids and then keeping them. You know, I got in and decided to get involved and committed to raise money and to have a project to equip Detroit with a decent science museum. And so I got a friend of mine to join me on the board, people from industry, from banking, others. And then
you raised a lot of money.
Right. I didn't know.
It very wisely, I may add. They did this massive expansion of the thing, but hyper cost effectively.
Yeah, we decided that we had built recently, before that, at that time, a plant in Mack Avenue, an engine plant. And I remembered that we spent $80 a square foot.
Right. And $80 square foot construction is very low cost, folks.
Right.
And we're talking everything. We're not just talking walls and a roof. We're talking
everything.
All the electrical, the whole nine yards.
So
right.
When we planned, like we were designing cars with the cost target in mind, we said, you know, if we let's assume we raise $25 million, because 15 is not enough, 80 we'll never raise, but let's say take 20 to 30. We need to make sure that we get as big of a building as we can for the money, and also money left to buy exhibits to populate the thing. So long story short, we decided to have a meeting with architect, and there was like 10 or 12 architectural firm who visit with us one day, and they all wanted to build to design our museum. And with a colleague of ours, John Miller, who was involved at the time, we started the meeting saying that before you give us your ideas, we have a target. We want to spend no more than $100 a square foot. So out of the 12, 11 stood up and left. And one firm stayed, and it was from Detroit. And we raised the money. We were $28 million. And in 2.5 years, we raised the money, and the building was designed and built. And we missed the target. It cost $110 a square foot. But it was a great ride. So we accomplished the mission there. And since then, that was in the we opened a new science center, or the renewed science center, which was 10 times bigger than the original one, in July of 2001. And since then, we've been learning how to run a science center, making it better, more relevant. But our mission is to inspire kids to listen more to their classroom, in the classroom, to their science teacher, and for the purpose of having a great career that would pay them well when they undergraduate from a college degree.
And you've got a charter school in there now, too, right?
Yeah, later on, 5 years ago, we were approached by Bob Thompson, who is known in town for having made a lot of money and he's spending it in building charter school, having predicted that the public system would collapse in Detroit.
Which
unfortunately has. But and so he was looking for great partnership to build charter school. And he said, we want to build a charter school on your parking lot, attached to you, so we'll create a math and science middle school. So we agreed, shook hands, and that's what we have done. So now we have 480 kids.
Including from the inner city.
Mm-hmm. Most of them that come every day. And the teachers in the school work with the educators in the science center, and they use the science center every day for demonstration and so on and so on. So it's a great partnership.
No, I think it's way cool, and I love seeing people like yourself give back to the industry. And I got to tell you, as a Frenchman, being here in Detroit, it's so cool to see somebody from outside of this country devoting so much to this city, too, that desperately needs all kinds of help.
Well, it's true that we came, like we were saying earlier, I remember landing here in 1980, and with my wife and two kids, two girls. And we've been so welcome in Detroit, in the greater Detroit area, that we always felt that it was just justice to give it back, because it changed our life for the good, and we have had a great life here. Detroit is an eyesore when friends from Europe come and unfortunately start their tour of the greater Detroit, downtown Detroit, and say, why have you let this city come to that point? So a combination of that and my passion to try to convince kids to have a career like mine, that would have been the main reason.
That's great. Maybe we'll have some Science Center kids designing the next generation F1 engine. That would be way cool.
Yeah, an engine for Mr. Gurney.
Yeah, there you go. But Francois, again, it's been great having you here.
Thank you.
And Jason, great having you here too, man.
I have 60 seconds to tell my favorite Francois story from Chrysler? This was back in 91, 92. He knows the one I'm going to tell. We had the Ultra Drive transmission, the A604. That was well ahead of its time, but not ready for prime time. And it was going to bankrupt the company, the defectiveness of the transmission. And Consumer Reports was ready to bury us. And it was going to cost us $4 billion to recall all the vehicles had. We only had $1 billion left. So all the brain trust at Chrysler got together in a meeting on the fifth floor. It was Ted Cunningham, the head of sales, Francois, Tom Gale, head of design, Steve Harris, head of PR, me and Tom Kowaleski and a few others. And we're debating whether or not we go into Consumer Reports and tell them they're just wrong and wrong and wrong, or if we try to be nice to them. And at one point, Francois looked up, he goes, I think we should clean their socks. And so we kind of looked at him like, this fuzzy little foreigner, and we went on, and we kept debating it. And then about a minute later, suddenly Francois was crying, laughing. He was just beside himself laughing. And Tom Gale goes, what are you laughing about? He goes,
I think I meant clean their clocks, not clean their socks. And so we later gave him a plaque with a pair of clean socks. So that became the running joke for the next 5 years in the PR department of we're going to clean their socks.
Yeah, that was the learning curve.
That is good.
On that high note.
Yeah.
And Peter, great having you here as always, too.
Always glad to be here.
And hey, don't forget, folks, we've got a little contest going where you can win a signed copy of Bob Lutz's new book, Car Guys versus Bean Counters. Just go to bit.ly/out-of-line-contest, bit.ly/out-of-line-contest.
Just got it today.
You can get that. Don't forget, you can always follow us at Facebook, facebook.com/out-of-line-detroit, twitter.com/out-of-line. You can always find Peter's stuff at autoextremist.com. And Jason, what are you pushing these days?
As always, Forgotten Harvest here in the Detroit area. They're doing wonderful things, and I know that there have been donations from people that watch this show. Every buck feeds five people. Every buck. If you're not in the Detroit area, there's a food, a rescue or a food shelter near you. Give to it. Give five. Give 10. Give 20 bucks. And help the, we're still not out of this bad economy, and there's a lot of people that are suffering, so make a donation to one of your food banks.
And also, folks, check out Roundabout tomorrow night. Check out the replay of Open Line on John's Journal. And thank you all for having tuned in tonight.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.